support for the Alaska Live series of live music and conversation on KUAC comes from Design Alaska. Design Alaska, architecture and engineering for the new frontier. Stay tuned. We're doing one last sound check and setup here for Alaska Live, and we'll be right back with you. And we are going to treat ourselves to just an excerpt of one of Rachel Barton Pine's violin concerto movements here from her CD. This is Mozart. Tonight she'll be on stage with the Paganini Caprices. So stand by. We'll be right back with Rachel Barton Pine on Alaska Live. Thank you. Hi, I'm your Alaska Live host, Rachel Barton Pine. It is a privilege to introduce you as KUAC's Alaska Live guest today. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
And you're going to start out with one of the Paganini Caprices to play. You can speak in our instrument mic just to introduce your piece. Just introduce your piece. It'll be good.
Okay. I thought I would start out with a little bit of Caprice number 9. It's in rondo form, and each time the rondo theme returns, Paganini indicates that you're supposed to imitate a pair of flutes and a pair of horns in between some contrasting sections.
And you're going to do that on the violin.
Of course.
Rachel Barton Pine joins us here in the KUAC studios for Alaska Live. And that was starting out the show with just fireworks from Paganini's Caprices. Rachel, that's just gorgeous. And technically, fireworks.
Yeah, well, Paganini's music is wonderful to listen to because he was such a great composer of melody. He lived at the same time as the opera composers in Italy, like Bellini and Donizetti, Verdi, Rossini, and his melodies are very much in that bel canto style. But of course, they're also great music to watch, and you can't see this over the radio airwave, but just the flying fingers and the fancy bow techniques and everything, it's like watching, you know, Olympic figure skaters doing all their jumps and twists and things. It's pretty fun.
Your bow was bouncing off of your strings in a controlled manner, mind you, but it was literally bouncing off your strings at times, and you're up and down the neck of the violin so quickly.
Yeah, lots of practice hours. People said that Paganini sold his soul to be able to play like that. But
right.
For me, it was just a lot of practicing.
Unlike Paganini, you do not claim to have sold your soul to the devil to play at a high ability. Just the other night, I think Marilyn Manson was on World Cafe claiming some of the same things as trading his soul for...
Oh, goodness.
I know, right?
Yeah, well, you know, people never tire of that stuff.
But right.
Paganini was kind of the guy that got it all started, and it's been really interesting how 200 years later, his legend lives on, not only in this wonderful music that classical musicians enjoy, but also in all kinds of other genres. Just Paganini, the sort of mystique, has been an inspiration to, you know, people as they're crafting their own images and so forth.
And tell me again, what year did he, what was his lifespan on that cover?
I don't have his dates off the top of my head, but the Caprices 18. Were written in the first decade of the 1800s.
Yes, that's what I thought. And so that, like you said, it was in the time of these great Italian operas. And
yeah, and he was really the first instrumentalist that achieved that same rock star status that previously only the singers had really enjoyed.
Right.
So, you know, and he had the long hair, he dressed all in black, he had lots of groupies. He would have been all over the tabloids if he'd lived these days. He was constantly, like, gambling and, you know, getting into trouble for, you know, seducing an underage girl or just all these kinds of wild things. But, you know, even though we kind of tend to remember the bad boy side of him because that's so juicy, he also had, you know, a really generous side, you know, and was a true artist. You know, his compositions, you know, he's got plenty of cheesy, flashy stuff, but you look at the Caprices, they're very serious-minded. They're not just a bunch of show-off kinds of things. They're really taking the violin to a whole nother level in terms of its expressive range and its tone colors.
Even within that one Caprice that you started out the show with, that moved from very fast and staccato to the lyrical, too. You said
exactly.
When you introduced it, the violin was to mimic a horn and a
flute.
And
yes.
A flute.
Well, you know, all this stuff about, you know, women would swoon at his concerts. I don't think it was just the flying fingers because, you know, a little bit of that goes a long way. After 10 minutes, it's like, okay, you can play fast. So what else is new? You know, it was the way that he touched their hearts through the expressiveness of his playing. And so it's that element that I always try to bring out in amongst all of the crazy gobbledygook.
And you are going to bring out all 24 of the Caprices, the complete Caprices of Paganini, tonight at the concert. You are in recital on Davis Concert Hall, and that is going to be really, really amazing that you're going to do the full 1 through 24 in order.
Yeah, well, it's quite a marathon for the player, but it actually is a normal length recital program. It's not longer than a typical concert you might attend. Maybe it's more dense with notes than what you would normally hear. But
I break
it up with, you know, stories of Paganini and talking about you know, some of what makes each Caprice special so that people have a little bit of a point of entry for listening to the cycle as it goes along. And, you know, it's just really such a wonderful exploration of what's possible on the violin to hear it all in one sitting. It's just a really fun adventure that you don't often get the chance to do.
And I just mentioned that all the notes on the page are black, but you have no music stand in here. There's no sheet music in front of you. You do
Actually, the memorization is the least of our worries because quite honestly, after you've put in the necessary number of hours to get the pieces clean and in tune and up to tempo and with some kind of musical meaning and interpretation, they're long since memorized. So, yeah, they're permanently in there. Of course, the memorization exists on various levels. There's the sort of intellectual memory of the structure of how the piece is put together, that macro kind of level that you really need to orient yourself, because you don't want to just memorize linearly, because then if your concentration lags for just a moment, you might lose your spot. But if you have a sense of the construct of the piece, then that's never going to happen. Then you, of course, have the aural memory, you know, just knowing how the piece sounds, and the reflexes, the muscle memory. Honestly, I could be you know, my mind could be wandering and my body would play one of these caprices at this point because, you know, my muscles just know how it goes.
Yeah.
But then, of course, it wouldn't be very expressive.
Right.
But I'm not worried about my fingers going into place because they've been trained and they've got their marching orders and they know what they're doing.
And you mentioned it is a bit like a marathon. We talk about, like, sports, you train for this, and you've trained to do this, all 24 of the caprices, all in order. And, you know, this Paganini stuff is very complex, and it takes a high caliber of ability to do that. How did you get to the point where you could do that to an audience?
Yeah, the tricky thing is, you know, I do other kinds of cycles, like the 6 Bach sonatas and partitas or the 5 Mozart concertos in a single evening. And each of those are obviously a challenge and a wonderful, amazing immersion for the audience. But it's in those cases, it's a lot of sort of the same kind of thing, you know, with enough variety that it's an interesting program. But it's physically and mentally, it's a lot more, the pieces are more similar to each other. With these caprices, Paganini was trying all kinds of different things, and that was kind of the point of it. And so really it's like, you know, beyond a decathlon, it's like you have to be good at the high jump and basketball playing and figure skating and, you know, maybe the hammer throw. You know, it's like you have to have all these different things at peak level simultaneously, even if each time you use it, you're only using that skill for a minute, and then another minute of something else, another minute of something else, and an hour and a half worth of that, but all these different things. And so it's kind of fun. It's a great feeling to be in that good shape. You know, you can go and play concerto after concerto, but you're not like in the peak condition that you're in when you're practicing all 24 caprices.
Because
so it's
when
kind
you're
of
playing,
a fun kind of thing. But it's also just, you know, as a fan of the violin, not just a player, but a fan, I love just seeing, you know, what the violin is capable of and being able to fully exploit its potential. And so, you know, at this point, I mean, when I was younger, you know, and I first did the cycle in my early 20s, it was just a question of, can I get through it? You know, the stamina thing, because even though it's not an overly long performance, the sheer concentration, not even muscle fatigue, but brain fatigue, I would start to go cross-eyed by the time I got about 7/8 of the way through and had to really build that up. But now it's just a question of, okay, what do I prepare first? What do I prepare next as I'm building it back up? And then, you know, little hardest spots and just kind of pacing it. Because if I was doing a mixed program where I was doing, let's say, a Bach sonata, a Beethoven sonata, a handful of caprices, maybe, you know, a little clump of 4 of them, and then a Brahms sonata. If I was doing that kind of a program, each caprice individually would get more practice time allotted to it. But when you're doing all 24, you have to be super, super efficient because you just can't indulge in practicing, let's say, the fingered octaves from number 17 as much as you would if you didn't also have all the other 23. And so you have your hours of the day are finite. And so you have to very, very carefully plan and pace and be just, you can't just start with, oh, what do I feel like practicing? And I'll practice it for as long as I want, and then I'll go on to whatever I want to next. And if you do that, you're going to be like, oh, darn, I'm out of time, and I've only practiced 16 caprices, even though that sounds like a preposterous thing to say.
Understand that you actually started to fall in love with these Paganini caprices at the age of 6, is that right?
6 or so, yeah. Aww. My mom, you know, I started violin when I was 3 because I had seen some middle school age girls playing violin in my church, and I just fell in love with the instrument. And after I started lessons that summer, my mom would go out to the local public library and get, you know, come home with LP recordings to inspire me. And she actually ended up buying a recording of the Paganini Caprices played by Itzhak Perlman. And I enjoyed that all through my single-digit years. It was one of my bedtime music, which sounds silly because it's not the kind of music that would lull you to sleep.
No, it's not lullabies.
But it was kind of a bribe kind of a thing because sometimes, you know, being a night person, I didn't want to lie down and go to bed. So my mom would be like, okay, I'll put on your Paganini record. So then I would lie still and just listen to these caprices and just dream of playing them one day. And I did indeed start learning the first one that I learned when I was 10, which is number 24, the very last caprice, and the most famous because it's in theme in variation form, and each variation has a different technique, and the theme is such a famous melody that it's been variated by all kinds of other composers, Rachmaninoff for piano, lots of different classical players, and even so many different non-classical genres have done versions of this famous 24th Caprice. So that's actually the next one I'm going to play for you.
Oh, wonderful. We should do that next.
Okay.
Okay, and so this is the finale of the Caprices, right? The 24th one. Rachel Barton Pine joins me here at the KUAC studios for Alaska Live. I'm your host. I'm Lori Neufeld. My guest today is violinist Rachel Barton Pine. Ooh, I can see why there was swooning going on during the Paganini performances, because I felt like swooning during that performance by you, Rachel. That was
fun stuff.
Fun stuff, for sure. Oof.
And that's, you can see where all those rock and roll licks came from, and the heavy metal guitarists. You know, since Van Halen, everybody, and Yngwie Malmsteen, you know, everybody's been practicing the Paganini caprices on the guitar and basically ripping off all these licks, but this is where it came from, and I think it sounds 10 times cooler on the violin.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, they've been putting in string chamber musicians into a lot of recordings since rock and roll started, also, it seems as though. So,
well, and ironically, so often underutilizing what the strings do. You know, you have these soaring long notes on the violin. It's like, wait a sec, the violin can play riffs. The violin can shred. Let's let the violins rock out.
Because you had a heavy metal band for a while, right? Earth and Grave.
For 5 years, yeah. Unfortunately, our main songwriter for the group just moved to Texas. And so the rest of us at home in Chicago, we decided to just shake hands and call it a day. But it was a fun 5-year run, and really great to be part of that type of creativity, because as a classical composer writing my own cadenzas and encore virtuoso pieces and things, you know, it's just me writing. That's the normal way we do it in classical. But in my band, it was fascinating to be part of a songwriting collective, you know, where each of us is contributing riffs and layering on our parts and discussing the form that the song should take and things like that. Like, well, let's do two of this and then put a bridge over here. And then, you know, it was really such an interesting experience to be part of writing our own songs.
In that band, you played an electric violin, I bet.
Well, not a regular, like, plugged-in violin, because honestly, playing my beautiful 1742 Guarneri del Gesu every day, you know, I want all the sound, the subtleties and nuances of the tone that I'm creating, you know, with my own hands. The idea of plugging it in and having it come out of an amp, that seems entirely unappealing. But every once in a while, you do want to play loud.
Yeah.
So the instrument that I actually got to use with my band is a flying V type instrument that has not only the four,
oh, like the flying V guitar.
Yeah, except this one straps onto your body, so you're not holding it with your head like you would a normal violin. Mm-hmm. Your head is completely free, so you can headbang while you play, but more importantly, it's like ergonomically good because you have the extra weight of the electronics going on, but I also have all the notes of the violin plus an extra lower octave, all the notes of the viola and most of the notes of the cello. So it's what's called extended range, and I can dig into the low notes and then, you know, play the leads on the high notes. And it's really like a whole different kind of an instrument.
You just mentioned your 1742 Guarneri. That's not a model number. That is the year of.
I love it.
Well, let's go back to that, Rachel Barton Pine.
Yeah,
you
absolutely
play a instrument from 1742.
Yeah, so Guarneri and Stradivari are considered to be the two greatest violin makers ever. It's a little bit like white wine and red wine. Neither one is better, but some people tend to gravitate towards one or the other. The Stradivaris have very sweet golden kind of sound. The Guarneris tend to be deeper and darker and richer on the lower end of the range. They're very powerful instruments, and there are fewer than a tenth as many remaining in the world as there are Stradivaris. So when, like me, your taste lies in the Guarneri direction, it's very, very lucky to have the use of one, because there just aren't that many to go around. Paganini also preferred the Guarneri sound to that of Stradivari, and in fact, his Guarneri was made in this same year, 1742. And so the sound of my instrument is very, very similar to the sound of Paganini's violin, needless to say. So it's perfect to play Paganini on. But it has a really amazing history.
And it's yours. That's for a lifetime loan.
Exactly.
It's lifetime loan.
It does not belong to me,
right,
but it is my other soulmate.
Yes.
Got my husband and my violin. Uh-huh. But yes, I'm so incredibly lucky that I have the use of this instrument and that I have just recently officially received it for lifetime use. So that's a great feeling of security, needless to say. And just, you know, it's wonderful to know that I'll be able to continue my partnership with it for the rest of my playing career,
and
because
so,
I really I hope it feels the same way, but I feel like we're a good match. And it's just an instrument. You know, it's very interesting. You know, after I met my husband, somehow or another, I stopped looking at other guys, like, you know, maybe an appreciation, but it wasn't like, who else is out there anymore? It just, you know, it felt right, and that was it. And the same thing with this violin. Hmm. All the other violins I had relationships with, you know, either on loan for long-term or short-term or whatever, it would be like, well, this is a beautiful instrument. It's really interesting. It's really inspiring. But, you know, I wonder what other violins out there sound like and stuff like that. And after I got this one, somehow or another, it's like all I want to do is play it. I don't even want to play any other violin.
The history behind a violin that was made in 1742 has to be a very rich history. And I know that there's a couple stories that you've researched and know about this.
Absolutely. Well, we don't know who played it in the 1700s, but in the first part of the 1800s, it was the concert instrument of one of the greatest of the Italian virtuosos immediately following Paganini, named Antonio Bazzini, who's most famous for his composition, The Round of the Goblins, which is a virtuoso piece with all those Paganini tricks that violinists still frequently play today. And then in the latter part of the 1800s, it was the concert instrument of one of the rare women violin soloists of that time, Marie Soldat. It's very interesting because sometimes there are, you know, instruments that are more subtle and delicate. They're considered ladies' violins, and some of the women violinists of the time, like Lady Halley, played a very beautiful Stradivari that was considered to be appropriate for a lady. But Marie Soldat, actually, it's very interesting when you read in the music magazines of the time, there are words, adjectives that are used to describe her playing, like virile. Which, think about a woman in the Victorian era being described as a virile player. That's kind of shocking.
Oh,
actually.
My.
She was apparently just a very strong, forceful personality. You know, she was a lady, too. She did get married and, you know, was a very, you know, elegant and refined person. But as a player, she was strong. She was a strong woman. And this violin, which is such a powerhouse, was the instrument that was chosen for her by Brahms, who was one of her teachers and mentors. I guess even back then, these things were often out of the reach of artists that might need them or deserve them. And so Brahms found an aristocratic family who agreed to purchase an instrument for Marie Soldat's use, and Brahms himself selected this one. So it's just amazing. For example, when I play the Brahms Violin Concerto, or more recently, the Brahms Lullaby for my little daughter on this violin whose voice Brahms selected, it's just an amazing feeling.
That's such a rich history behind an instrument that you call your soulmate. And it's from 1742. And there's just not very many instruments out there anymore that are have such a rich history, because they're either in collectors' hands because they don't get to be played anymore because they're...
Yeah. Well, actually, it's very interesting. For more than 100 years, instruments have never gone down in value.
Yeah.
In other words, it's an extremely secure investment. It's not very liquid, but it's extremely secure. And so people of a certain income bracket do, from time to time, diversify their portfolios, so to speak, by buying a couple violins. And the tragic thing is when they get stored in a vault, the owners might think that that's the best thing to do with them, but in fact it's not. Because, when you're just letting the instrument sit around and not be played, its voice kind of goes to sleep. Imagine if you didn't talk for 10 years. You'd be pretty croaky when you started to speak again, right? It's not healthy for the instruments. And furthermore, in terms of the investment, actually, if the instruments are out there being played in high-profile situations, being recorded for posterity, it adds to their legacy, what we call provenance. And so, in fact, it increases the value of the instrument to be adding to its history. So it's not just, of course, it is very generous for owners to loan them to players, but it's also in their own best interest, and it's sad when people don't realize that. It's sad for them, it's sad for the players who don't have enough instruments to go around, and it's sad for the public because the makers, Stradivari, Guarneri, Amati, all those wonderful makers, they made these things to be living voices.
Right.
And if those voices are still in existence in the world but silenced, you know, that's just really sad.
You, as a musician of your caliber, would hate to see a violin like this Guarneri locked up for decades or a century or more. And so it's good that it is in your hands right now. And hopefully, you know, in 2,172, you know.
Exactly. Oh, yeah, I mean, even the owner can truly never feel like they own it. I mean, legally they do, I suppose. Yeah. But because these things are going to outlive us, you know, we are only ever their temporary caretakers and privileged to be a small part of their long life. So it's fun to think about, you know, my adventures, but also my violin's adventures, because last year was this Guarneri's first ever visit to Alaska when I played with the Anchorage Symphony. And now this violin is returning to Alaska for the second time. And it is, of course, well, it's called the Ex-Soldat. So
had a name with it when it came to you.
Yeah. Well, see, it never gets named after somebody unless they're dead. Uh-huh. So maybe someday it might be the Ex-Pine, but I'll never find out about it because I'll be dead. But in any case, this is the Ex-Soldat's second time to Alaska, but first time in Fairbanks.
When Zuhal Bailey was here several winters ago, it was hovering around 45, 50 below. And so cellist Zuhal Bailey was here with his cello that's from similar era.
Similar era.
And a very old instrument also on loan to him. And he said he was keeping his cello in the bathroom with the shower on
hot. Yeah, he told me about that advice, and we actually did that exact same thing last night. We turned our shower on and just let it run.
Yeah, so it got humidified and happy again.
It's funny, we worry more about the wood of the violin than we do about our own skin, you know, because, I mean, you can always put some lotion on yourself, but you can't exactly do that with your poor instrument, so you gotta get the humidity going. And it's fun to just think about, you know, what it gets to experience and what it gets to see.
And speaking of Zuhal Bailey, you'll be in concert with Zuhal Bailey and Eduard Zilberkant down in Anchorage this weekend, right?
Yeah, playing Brahms on this Brahms violin. Mm. We're doing the wonderful B major trio, and I'll also be doing the Sonat and Satz. And then, of course, the 24 Caprices the next night in Anchorage.
Oh, great.
So it's always fun to play with Zuhal. He has such wonderful energy in his playing, and it just, you know, sort of, whenever I play with him, I feel like that extra spark going on.
I can imagine the dynamite that's going off on the stage with Eduard Zilberkant at the piano, Zuhal Bailey cello, and Rachel Barton Pine violin. What a trio. I am so happy to hear that you're in Alaska. A little sad to hear that that's not part of the tour here in Fairbanks, but you are doing the Caprices tonight on the Davis Concert Hall stage, and that's at 8 o'clock, and that is some fire in itself. So you are also playing the Caprices down in Anchorage, you say?
Yep.
Yeah.
I just finished up a run in various cities in Arizona, and before that in Virginia, and then I go on to New York, and then I set the Caprices aside till May in Montreal, and I do concertos going to Finland and England and Detroit. It's always so random. It's a complete zigzag. But it means my daughter is already an exec platinum flyer, which is quite hilarious.
Your daughter accompanied you, your whole family accompanied you up here to Alaska, right?
Yeah, well, my husband has been traveling with me for almost 20 years and runs his company from the road. Luckily, with computers, you can do that these days, keeping in touch with his clients via cell phone and internet and supervising his employees virtually. It's pretty crazy, but we make it work. And then when our daughter was born 3 years ago, we got a nanny from an agency of nannies for traveling musicians.
There's that.
So, yeah, it's awesome. So she gets to see the world and never be apart from mom and dad and come to my concerts. And, now she travels with her own little teeny tiny violin.
I was going to ask. So she has picked up the violin also. Was she always fascinated by your playing?
Well, you know, some friends gave me some great advice because, you know, sometimes it's hard for your baby not to be jealous of your instrument, because if you've got the violin in your hands, you don't have the baby in your hands. And so how do you work that out? So some friends advised me when she was first born and went down for a nap and all I wanted to do was nap myself. They said, even if you don't want to practice, even if you don't need to practice, just practice, because then she'll get used to the violin being there, being a part of her life. And so actually, even when she was awake and she'd be sitting in her bouncy chair when I wasn't nursing her or something, then, you know, I would play the violin for her. And I think she got this idea in her mind that the violin existed for her entertainment.
That was together time.
So, yeah, so I was just always serenading her. And now she'll, like, sit on the couch for 45 minutes and not even read a book, just sit there and watch me and just comment on what I'm doing and just be really fascinated. So that's awesome. It's like, you know, the best possible audience of one.
Dream come true.
Exactly.
And to have your daughter sit and listen to you practice, she has
actually,
to...
Actually, it sets the bar really high. Yeah. It's yeah. like I cannot let my mind wander. I don't want to, you know, accidentally like fluff a note or have an out of tune note go by and not notice it. It's like I got to play as well as I possibly can because this is a formative young brain here that I don't want to get any, you know, anything less than my best into her growing, you know, musical ears.
You're an accomplished musician, and you're setting the bar high for mothers, I think, out there. But you're setting it to, you know, this is possible that you can be a professional musician and a mom all at the same time.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, you know, for me, living in hotels is my normal life. And so bringing along my daughter to be part of my life is the most natural thing in the world. But, of course, I couldn't do it without help. And so it's, I do want to spread the word that this is possible. And, you know, I was lucky that breastfeeding went really well for us and I was able to do that. And as much as that might sound like a challenge to have to worry about, you know, arriving at the next destination and pumping and then, you know, making sure that I ran back to my dressing room during rehearsal break and all of that, it was actually far easier than if I had gone in the other direction because, you know, if the flight was delayed or something like that, like I could always feed her. I was right there. And she never had to worry about the luggage being lost or running to the store. Like, her food was always with us.
How old was she when she took her first flight?
3 weeks.
Oh, 3 weeks.
Yeah. But, you know, people say, oh, that was so soon. But actually, you know, you're not allowed to get on an airplane the last 6 weeks of your pregnancy. So 6 weeks plus 3 weeks, I had not left my apartment for 9 weeks. I don't think I'd done that since I was, like, 18 or something. Uh-huh. I was like, I got to get out of here. Get back on the road where I'm used to living. Yeah. You know, get back to the hotels where somebody else washes my sheets and brings me my room service. So actually, it was great.
Should we hear another piece from you on this violin? I know you have two violins here, but...
Oh, well, the Baroque violin is for a concert in Buffalo.
Okay.
Of Baroque music.
But let's...
In any case, I'll just continue on with this one since that's one I've got all tuned up right
that
now.
That is your soulmate there, so you need to continue on with that one.
Yeah. Well, I know there was a request for me to do something slightly non-classical, so... Speaking of all the traveling, of course, my hometown is Chicago. I grew up there and I've lived there my whole life. It's centrally located, so it works out real well. And actually, we get our share of cold weather there, so I'm not too intimidated by being up here in Alaska. But anyway, one of our you know, best loved forms of what you might call indigenous music in Chicago is the blues. Yeah. So I grew up with the blues and love to do that on my violin every once in a while as a little bit of an indulgence. So thought I'd share some of that with you guys.
Wonderful.
So this is actually a medley I put together of three famous Chicago songs. The first two are actually jazz tunes. Chicago, Chicago, that toddle in town that a lot of people know in the Frank Sinatra version. The middle tune is not as famous outside of Chicago, but it's a jazz tune called My Kinda Town, Chicago Is. And then everybody knows Sweet Home Chicago from the Blues Brothers.
Yeah. Rachel Barton Pine, violinist, is my guest here on KUAC's Alaska Live. She is in recital on the Davis Concert Hall tonight at 8 o'clock and will be playing all 24 of Paganini's Caprices starting at 8 o'clock tonight on the Davis Concert Hall stage here at UAF. And this is something she's chosen to play that is the Chicago Medley.
Chicago Medley, exactly. Thank you.
Rachel Barton Pine, that was magnificent. Also, much like the rockin' style of Paganini, that was some rockin' Chicago blues. It was amazing.
I expect if Paganini had lived to the 21st century, he would have been doing distortion also.
Totally. You even have a concert series called Shredding with the Symphony, which encompasses some like Metallica and AC/DC and heavy metal.
Rock music is my second favorite kind of music. Yes. And so I like to use that as an opportunity to bridge the gap with my fellow rock fans to say, hey, you don't have to choose between rock and classical. You can love both of them. A lot of the great rock bands are actually very inspired and influenced by classical themselves. And so what I do with some of these programs is, you know, I'm not out there for the purpose of playing rock music on my violin, because that's not where my heart lies artistically, but to use rock music to bring people into classical. So what I've been doing for many years with chamber music at sort of what you would call an outreach concert, going into a local pub, you know, playing some AC/DC or Led Zeppelin, and then playing some Shostakovich, some Paganini, some, you know, exciting Isai sonata movements or whatever, and then encouraging people to come to the orchestra concert. So now I've kind of morphed that or evolved that into an actual orchestra concert that, again, is not just, you know, the symphony plays rock music, but it's taking some of these, my orchestrations of some of these medleys, Metallica or whatever, and then playing of movement of the Sibelius violin concerto, movement of the Brooke violin concerto, real serious heavy-duty classical music, so that the hope is that people will come for the rock music that they know and love and then discover that this great classical music is like just as awesome as the rock music, if not more so, and then hopefully come back another night for a purely classical concert.
And, you know, classical music has been the popular music of its day for many centuries, and now you're kind of melding that into one and drawing people back into classical through some popular music. And like you say, you're not there to play, you know, heavy metal music on the violin with the symphony. You're there to turn people on to classical music. And I think that can be done that way.
Well, that's certainly the hope. Yes. And expectation. Mon Powell, my musical hero, who just got the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Grammys last year as the first woman instrumentalist of any genre. You know, she was America's first great violin virtuoso, who lived from 1867 to 1920 and actually hailed from my home state of Illinois. Maude Powell was the Victor Talking Machine Company's first instrumental recording star in the early days of the phonograph, and they were constantly urging her to record popular tunes played on the violin. And she said, no, I'm going to play, you know, the greatest works of classical music. Well, of course, whatever of those were 5 minutes or less, but, you know, whatever she could in those days, Meditation from Thais and all these, you know, the Last Movement of the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto, all these things that she recorded. And she said, look, popular music is familiar music. And if I continue to advocate for this wonderful classical music, it will become more familiar and therefore more popular. And she was absolutely right. People all across the U.S. bought the newfangled phonograph just for the purpose of listening to Maude Powell's records.
She was right.
It's a great inspiration.
Rachel, you are a wealth of information about powerful women in classical music from history. I love that about how you speak so excitedly about classical music and these women that were just absolute powerhouses in their day. It's great.
Yeah, there weren't as many of them as there are these days, and it's just fascinating because obviously the ones that were around and, you know, pursuing their art, you know, were consciously choosing to go against the norms of their day, and so they're not only great artists, but they're very interesting just personalities.
You have made it one of your goals to give back to a community of inspiring artists and artists that may not have the means to head out to competitions like they'd like to, or artists that are in countries that may not have classical musical instruments at their disposal. And you've made that one of your goals to start foundations and scholarships for those things.
Yes, for more than 10 years now, I've had my REB Foundation, which is the not-for-profit that my husband and I started back in 2001. And we've supported more than 50 young artists so far through instrument loans of rare antiques, as well as fine contemporary instruments or small size instruments even for talented children, and also financial assistance. The financial assistance program is pretty unique because it's not a scholarship. It doesn't cover the cost of your lessons, but it covers all those things that traditional scholarships don't cover. For families that are really struggling, but where the young artist, the student or young professional is really desiring to have a life in music and really talented and deserving of that. Some families can't pay for concert clothes, for new strings for the instrument, for piano accompanists or audition recording sessions. I'll give you a really good example of how our foundation made a difference. There was a 14-year-old girl being raised with her siblings by her single mother. And she got a full scholarship to Juilliard Pre-College. And her mother could not afford the gas, tolls, and parking to take her from upstate New York down to Manhattan every week for her free lessons. Oh. And of course, Juilliard wasn't going to pay for that gas, tolls, and parking. So that's where our foundation stepped in. And just, it's like, when is 100% not good enough? And so that's sort of what we're helping with, is that sort of forgotten piece of the puzzle. Yeah. And it's really a reflection of the challenges that I had during my own childhood with a father who was unemployed for much of my youth. And my mom was raising me and my younger sisters, homeschooling me so that I had enough time to practice. And so things were very tenuous with our phone and electricity frequently being cut off and not always knowing how we were going to pay for groceries and take me to my lessons that week. And so it was quite a struggle and quite a challenge to just hold on to my belief that I was meant to be a violinist, that this dream made sense under these seemingly insurmountable obstacles, under these circumstances. So, some generous people helped me along the way, and I felt that starting this foundation for that same purpose would be the best way to give back.
I was just going to say, giving back to that community where you know so well, and now you're making it possible for some of these kids and young adults to achieve their dreams, or at least pursue their dreams. Because when you stand on stage at a competition, you have to have the right outfit and the right instrument, and not just the practice time. Practice time kind of comes for free, but those other things don't.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy, like the things that young artists can't afford. Like, they'll have, an instrument on loan from a generous patron, but they won't have a case to put it in a safe case. Yes. That's not falling apart. And they don't have, the hundreds of dollars that it would take to buy that case. So it's those little things. In your music school, is that going to buy you a case? So who's going to buy that case for you? So, and of course, there are competitions out there, and whoever wins first prize gets a good chunk of change.
Yes.
But the person that wins second prize maybe was able to make ends meet and cover their airfare to get to the competition. But often it's really just more a case of being able to add a credential to your resume, but not necessarily coming out in the black from having done those competitions. So, there's really not that many sources of support out there available for people who are in particularly, desperate financial conditions.
Rachel Barton Pine, it has been such a fast hour that went by. This time went so fast with us because you are an amazing talent on the violin, and you know so much about the landscape of being a professional violinist out there in the world, and it's been great to have you here on KUAC's Alaska Live.
Well, it's been great to be here. Thanks so much for having me on, and can't wait to play the Caprices in the coldest climate. I play them in the highest altitude I've yet played them, when I did them in Flagstaff two nights ago, And that was really a challenge because I felt like I was out of breath after every caprice.
You're like, am I out of shape? No.
It was like extreme performing. But, you know, here it might be cold, but the concert hall, I assume, won't be. So it won't be quite as bad as that.
You may have needed to have done some blood doping or something before that Flagstaff performance.
I'll have to try that next time. Yeah,
that high
I'll just keep myself and my instrument humidified through the afternoon, and I should be good to go.
Well, we'll make sure that it's warm in there for sure. It's UAF Davis Concert Hall. Tonight, you are playing all 24 of Paganini's caprices on stage. Rachel Barton Pine, thank you so much for taking the time and playing and having a conversation with me. I'm your host, Lori Neufeld, for Alaska Live. And thanks to Fairbanks Symphony's George Rydlinski for the logistics help and KUAC's intern, Brady Gross. For KUAC, I'm Lori Neufeld.